Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Donald Kurtz with the Songs of Stars.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Greg, for that introduction. Good evening, everyone. As Greg said, I do have roots in this part of Canada. When my wife and I moved to Lancashire 11 years ago, we moved to a town called Preston. Now, we came from Cape Town, and people there say, you came from Cape Town with its beautiful sun, its beaches. Why did you want to come here to Preston? And I say to them, well, my mother was born in Preston. And they look at me a little bit puzzled because they can hear my obvious North American accent, and so I let them off the hook and I say, well, Preston, Ontario. And they seem to find that to be a very good answer. So it's a pleasure for me to come tonight back to my family roots and to talk to you. I'm going to start tonight with a trip to the constellation Orion. Now, this is a constellation many of you might recognize, the Belt of Orion. It's setting right now outside, low in the southwest. Mintaka, Alnilam, and Alnitak are the stars of the belt. Betelgeuse, the bright red star in the shoulder of Orion, if you put that where the sun is, the entire solar system out to Jupiter would be inside its surface. Rigel down in the upper thigh, left thigh of Orion. This is not a picture of the sky. This is a computer-generated movie made by a friend of mine, Zoltan Koloth. It's accompanied by some music, and I'll tell you about the music in a little bit. We're going to take a trip to Orion at 200 million times the speed of light. The distances have been measured by a satellite called the Hipparcos mission. They are accurate distances. And things I'd like you to watch for. Most stars in the galaxy, most stars in the universe, tiny little faint red stars, much fainter than the sun. You normally don't notice them, but as we speed off to Orion, you'll see them coming towards you. You'll also notice that Star Trek, notwithstanding, Warp 10 in Star Trek, the stars whiz by. They don't whiz by in this movie. If I shrank your head down to the size of the sun, sun's entirely gaseous, 700,000 kilometers in radius, but we're going to make it the size of your head. On that scale, and you all know how far the next star is away, it just came up here before I started talking, Alpha Centauri at 4 times 10 to the 13 kilometers, 40 trillion kilometers. If we shrink my head down to the size of Alpha Centauri, then your head needs to be in Halifax and mine's in Vancouver. The stars are a long, long way away. That's very strange music you're listening to. The compositions by a Hungarian composer by the name of Jano Koehler. He did it with the help of my friend and colleague, astrophysicist Zoltan Koloth, and you'll hear more of Zoltan this evening. Every instrument in the orchestra you're listening to right now is a real star. Those are the sounds of the stars. At the moment, that should sound unbelievable to you, but as the evening goes on, I'll show you how that's true, and I'll show you how we use those sounds to see the places in the universe we could never have seen before. When I was a student in San Diego 40 years ago, I had a book on my shelf by the great British astrophysicist Sir Arthur Stanley Eddington. Now, Eddington in 1919 sent out expeditions to observe an eclipse of the sun to measure the bending of starlight by the general relativity theory of Albert Einstein. So that general relativity theory is fundamental to most of the work that happens at Perimeter Institute, and Eddington is the one who actually proved that the theory was correct in 1919. He's also the one that suggested that the sun generates its energy by fusing the lightest element, hydrogen, to helium. By the late 1930s, we understood that completely. By the 1950s, unfortunately, we were doing it with hydrogen bombs. But at the moment, we're working on power plants that use hydrogen fusion, controlled hydrogen fusion. The engineering's difficult. But I would say in this century, it's my guess that we will control hydrogen fusion, and that will become the power source for humanity. Once we've done that, we will generate our energy in no other way. We get vastly more energy from our other energy sources. There are no greenhouse gases coming out of it. It's the ultimate energy source for humans. And it comes from an understanding of theoretical physics, an understanding of the stars. It's the biggest economic payoff of all time. I think that'll come in this century. Eddington started this book, The Internal Constitution of the Stars, a book that was 40 years old when I was a student, with these words. He said, at first sight, the deep interior of the sun and stars is less accessible to scientific investigation than any other region of the universe. Our telescopes may probe farther and farther into the depths of space, but how can we ever obtain certain knowledge of that which is hidden behind substantial barriers? What appliance can pierce through the outer layers of a star and test the conditions within? Eddington had a brilliant answer to that question. It's an answer that resonates here at the Perimeter Institute. Theoretical physics, we can calculate the inside of a star. We understand the laws of gas, and stars are made of gas. We understand the laws of motion. We understand chemistry. We can calculate a star. But Eddington also warned on that very first page of that book, something we know well as scientists, when theory gets too far away from observation, usually we go wrong. Eddington never guessed that we would be able to see inside a star. But starting from the time I was an undergraduate, a new field arose. It's booming now. It's a big field. It's called astroseismology. That apparent drumming sound you were just listening to was the sound of a pulsating red giant. That was actually recorded by my close colleague, Connie Arts, who's professor at Leuven University in Belgium. And when she and her team released that sound a few years ago, she came to me shortly thereafter and she said she had discovered that the young people were dancing to that in the discos. Now, we astronomers are often asked this very difficult question, what good is astronomy? And when it's asked in that tone, the person means money. Well, that sound you were just listening to was recorded with one of the world's biggest telescopes, the Very Large Telescope in Chile. We cost it about 100,000 Canadian per night, and we've made disco music. What better application could you ask for? Now, when the talk's over tonight, there is, of course, a book stand outside, and it will not have this book on it. This is the first fundamental textbook in this field, and I can assure you the first six pages are completely readable. But I'm telling you that story tonight. I wrote those pages, and I'll tell you the story tonight. After that, it's mathematical for the next 900 pages. But there's your resource if you'd like more information for now. Let me take you back 2,500 years to a man whose name you know well, Pythagoras. You remember him from school, from the Pythagorean theorem, a squared plus b squared equals c squared for a right triangle. Well, Pythagoras had a long life. He lived into his 90s. To some extent, what I'm telling you about him is uncertain because his history wasn't really written, his biography, until centuries after his death. But I'll give you the standard story that people think they know about him. He immigrated from Samos, off the coast of Turkey, to southern Italy when he was about 40, to a place called Croton. He founded the Pythagorean Brotherhood, and they had substantial secular power. They ruled over a significant piece of Magna Graecia, not to the liking of the local population. So there was political upset with his rule. They were, in the sense of modern scientists, natural philosophers who believed that there was a harmony to the universe, that music, mathematics, what we now call physics, were related to each other. We physicists still think that. Nobody knew what the planets were then. If you could go out tonight, if it clears up, I hope you've been watching over the last few months the brilliant planet Venus, low in the western sky, Mars high up in the constellation Leo, Saturn farther over to the east. We've got a beautiful set of planets in the sky right now. At the time of Pythagoras, nobody knew what those planets were. They didn't know why they moved. And so the Pythagoreans believed that the stars turned in the sky and the planets moved through the stars and the sun and the moon on crystalline spheres that spun. And as they spun, they hummed and they made a music of the spheres. That idea caught on in Western thought, and it's reverberated down for 2.5 millennia. So it's an expression that you know. We still talk today about the music of the spheres. A century after Pythagoras, Plato said that a siren sits on each planet who carols a most sweet song, agreeing to the motion of her own particular planet, but harmonizing with all the others. 2,000 years later, the great German astrophysicist Johannes Kepler, his name you'll hear again later this evening, was trying to puzzle out the nature of the motion of the planets around the sun. And in the process, he thoroughly believed in the Pythagorean music of the spheres. What you see on the screen here is from one of his books. That musical notation was Kepler trying to match the orbits of the planets, their motion around the sun, to a harmonic idea. One of the things that made him a great scientist is that after a decade of trying to do that, it didn't work, he gave it up, and he went back and discovered the true laws of motion of the planets around the sun, things we now call Kepler's laws. Two generations later, arguably the greatest theoretical physicist of all time, Isaac Newton, then calculated from basic principles the motion of the planets by using his new law of gravity he had invented and found Kepler's laws. With Kepler, the idea of the music of the spheres died in science for four centuries. It survived in art, it survived in literature. You can find everything in Shakespeare. From The Merchant of Venice, he says, "There's not the smallest orb which thou beholdest, but in his motion like an angel sings, still choiring to the young-eyed cherubim." For four centuries then, we scientists ignored the music of the spheres. But it came back starting when I was a student, and it's now here with us a very big field, this field of astroseismology. You and I are very visual creatures. We say, seeing is believing. No, I've got a beautiful golden retriever. I like to take her for a walk, and we chat when we're on the walk. I talk to her about things, and she says, seeing's okay, but if you really want to know something, you need to smell it. She says, smelling's believing. There are other animals that find their way around the environment through sound. Bats, for example, echolocating, and I'll come back to them in just a bit. What's happening when you see? As you're sitting there now, looking at me, looking at the screen, you've got this movie theater running in your mind. The light's entering your eye. It's being focused on your retina, and then the energy from the light's absorbed by your body. And it's turned into an electrochemical signal that passes down your optic nerve to the parts of your brain that interpret vision, and there's that movie theater running in your mind. As I speak to you, I'm causing your eardrum to vibrate in and out. That energy is transferred to the bones in your ear, and then it's absorbed by your body. And it travels as an electrochemical signal, very similar to the one that goes down your optic nerve, but to a different part of your brain. And you experience sound very differently to the way you experience sight. Animals that use sound to navigate their environment probably have movie theaters running in their minds. When I was a graduate student in Texas, I did a lot of caving. And we wouldn't go in caves during the day. Why waste the daylight hours? We'd stay out and swim in the river and climb the rocks during the day. And then when the sun went down, we'd go crawling into the caves as 10,000 bats were coming out. Now, it's messy. You get used to it. But they don't hit you. They don't hit each other. They get outside in the dark and they catch the tiniest little insects in their environment by broadcasting sound and getting the echo back. They see with sound. We now know how to do that. We humans know how to do it. We do it in hospitals. There with ultrasound is the picture of the face of a baby before it's born. We've used sound to get the information, and then because we're such visual creatures, we've turned it into a visual picture. And the story I'm going to tell you tonight is how I use sound in stars to look inside those stars. I can see the inside of the sun, that place that Eddington said was the most inaccessible place in the universe to observation. I can see that at this scale in more detail than you can see the face of that fetus. What is sound? Sound's a pressure wave. This graphic you're looking at here is to indicate the molecules of air in this room. You're breathing 78% nitrogen molecules, 21% oxygen, 1% argon, and a few other trace atoms and molecules. And as my sound from my voice sends these waves out through the room, the air is compressed and rarefied and comes out to you at 343 meters per second, the speed of sound, and pushes your eardrum in and out. Now, the speed of sound depends on temperature. If the gas in this room were hotter, the molecules would move faster. They would collide more often. And if they move faster and collide more often, that would cause the sound to move faster. On the other hand, if we breathe lighter gases, helium, for example, the sound would move much more quickly at the same temperature because the gas is so much lighter. So you've done this before yourselves, probably. There's a balloon full of helium gas. And if I fill my lungs with it, then the frequency of my voice goes up by about a factor of 3, because the speed of sound is much faster in helium than it is in air. Now, I'm hoping that my voice is actually going to go back to normal for the rest of this talk. What's my point to you? Stars are made of gas, and what I do is measure the speed of sound in the star, and that immediately tells me how hot the star is down through its interior, what it's made out of, the chemical composition, and those are related through fundamental laws of physics to pressure and density and the interior conditions. So I can see inside the star. We humans have a range of hearing between about 30 cycles per second to about 18,000 for the young ones in the audience. I see some people out here who can hear 18,000 cycles per second. I can't. And most of you who are over 30 can't. We lose our high-frequency hearing as we get older. There's a controversy in England right now. A man invented a device he calls the mosquito, and it's actually a kid repellent. In neighborhoods where they have problems with bad behavior by the teenagers, they put these up in front of shops, and it lets out a terrible squeal at 18,000 cycles per second. And the kids can't stand it, and the adults can't hear it. So there's our range of hearing. What about the bats? There's a leaf-nosed bat. It's beautiful, isn't it? He lets out a scream so loud that he would do damage to his own ears, so he disconnects his ear bones while he screams, and then he reconnects them and he listens. And he can do that about 60 times per second. Evolution is amazing. And the sound comes back, that thing on his nose beams it out, those big ears catch it, and he's got that movie theater running in his mind. Fortunately, we can't hear him. Fortunately for us and fortunately for him, we're not too good at sharing the environment with things we don't like. We can put instruments out that can hear what he sounds like, and then we can shift the sound of the bat down into the audible. How do we do that? Well, we divide the frequencies until they're within the audible range, but we remain true to the original music. Many of you here are musicians. And what we do with that is we keep the ratios of the frequencies to the same, we keep the loudness of the sounds the same, we keep what we call the phase, when the sounds start, the same. In music, we call that a key change. Something's written in B-flat and you decide to play it in A. If you've got perfect pitch, that'll bother you. If you're like me without perfect pitch, boy, that's the right melody. I hear the same melody. That's the music. And so in that sense, the sound of the bats is true to what they would sound like if you could hear them. They are incredibly loud, nothing like you're hearing now. And if we could actually hear them, we'd probably drive them to extinction. They need that high frequency to be able to see well. Now, if you can believe that's what bats would sound like, and I think you find that plausible, when we shift the sound into the audible, then that's what we're doing with the sound of the stars. The sound of the stars is too deep to hear. Let me give you an example of that. You've many times heard the songs of the whales. That was a warning call from a blue whale, and it's much louder than you just heard. It's too deep for us to hear well, and so we've shifted into the audible. And so if you can believe, oh yeah, well that's what a whale would sound like if I can hear it, then the star sounds that you hear from me are what the stars would sound like if you could hear them. The sounds from the stars are too deep to hear, and we shift them into the audible. By the way, these blue whales can let out a scream so loud that if you were 1 meter from the front end of a blue whale when it let out its loudest call, it would put out a sound at 180 decibels. The loudest thing that you can stand without ear damage is 120. And so they let out screams that are a million times louder than the loudest sounds that we can stand. If you were in the water with that whale when it did that, the concussion from the sound would probably kill you. What it does mean is that even though there are only a few thousand of them left, they can talk to each other from the Arctic to the Antarctic, across the entire planet. Let's talk about what sound is like and how it's generated, and I want to show you musical instruments. This graphic is to represent a stringed instrument. Imagine a violin, imagine a guitar. The fundamental mode on a guitar, and I'm using a word starting with M, mode, has the string simply moving up and down, as you see on the left there, and that gives you the basic frequency from the string. There's another mode that has a node in the middle, that's with an N, and that node's a point that doesn't move. If you play guitar, touch the 12th fret. You don't have to push down on it, and you can get it to oscillate in that first overtone. That First overtone, you can see the graphic, has twice the frequency of the fundamental. It's up by one octave. The second overtone has two nodes. You can see how the sides go down, the middle comes up, and it has a frequency three times the fundamental. Those are the things that we call harmonic in Western music. Low frequency ratios of 2-1, 3-2, 4-3 is what we build our music out of, and our musical instruments are designed to be harmonic. Here's another example of a one-dimensional harmonic oscillator that I think all of you are familiar with, the baseball bat. It's got natural oscillation modes. You can see three of them on the left there. And over on the right, they're all put together in a still graphic. Now, the bat, the handle end, is over there on the right for you, and the business end is over here on the left. And quite clearly, what you want to do when you're playing baseball is hit the ball right there on the sweet spot, and you all know what that feels like. It's fantastic. You hit the ball there, and it's out over center field wall. Hit it on the end of the bat, and the bat will buzz sometimes that it falls out of your hands and your hands are numb because you've put a lot of energy into vibrating the bat, and typically then the ball dribbles out to the pitcher and he throws you out at first and that's it. These oscillations I'm talking to you about tonight in the stars have applications in many, many other fields of physics and normal everyday life. I'd like you to imagine for the moment now that I've got the KW Philharmonic Orchestra up here behind me, and mentally close your eyes. And the first violinist gets up over here, and she walks over to the piano, and she plinks middle A, 440 hertz. And now every instrument in the orchestra starts tuning up on middle A. And your eyes are closed. They're all playing exactly the same note, and yet you can hear the violin, you can hear the French horn, you can hear the oboe, you can hear the clarinet, you hear the bassoon, you hear the trumpet. How do you do that? How come you can tell the difference in the instruments with your eyes closed when they're all playing the same note? And the answer is in the harmonics. If you've got a simple sound wave, this thing on the left shows you the way the pressure in the atmosphere goes. It looks just like an ocean wave. And on the right, we get a frequency, and the little red bar shows you how loud it is. That's a pretty dull sound. That's kind of an electronic whistle. But if you now begin to add the harmonics, the shape of the wave changes. And so as you get more and more higher harmonics with notes added, the shape of the sound wave becomes very sharp. It rises quickly and falls off more slowly. That pushes your eardrum in differently. And you and your brain can actually disentangle those frequencies, and you hear the timbre of the musical instrument. And so you hear the shape of musical instruments. Let me take you to two dimensions, and then I'll come back to that point. Let's look at the situation for drums. Drums are nice two-dimensional oscillators. And on the left there, I'll show you the fundamental mode for a drum. The rim is a node, it doesn't move, and the center of the drum moves up and down like this. We call that the fundamental radial mode, radial because it's circularly symmetric. We can have a circle on the drum head, which is a node. So instead of a point on the string, it's now a circle on the drum head, and the first overtone looks like this. The middle comes up while the outside goes down and vice versa. You can have two circles for the second overtone mode, it looks like that. Or the drum being two-dimensional can have nodes in another direction. It can have nodes which are lines across the drum. In this case, there's a line across the drum that doesn't move. One side goes down while the other comes up. That's called the dipole mode. You can have two lines crossing at 90 degrees for the quadrupole mode. And you can have a dipole mode with a first radial overtone mode with a circle. The nodes can go in both directions. It looks like this. These two-dimensional oscillators do not have simple frequency ratios. It's not 2-1, 3-2, 4-3, the things we call harmonic. And so two-dimensional oscillators typically don't give us a musical note. They give us a crash. When I get back to the sounds of the stars are not harmonic either, and mostly their sounds are pretty grating to us. We can occasionally pick a few which sound nice, but most stars do not have harmonic sounds, as the drums don't, because they're more complex than the string situation. Here's some more two-dimensional oscillators. These are the front and back faceplates of violins. They've actually been suspended horizontally in space in a laboratory at the University of New South Wales in Australia. And they're made to vibrate by putting sound on them. And they've got carbon dust on the surface, soot. And the carbon dust settles into the nodes on the front and back faceplates of the violin, and you'll see that the nodes are very complex compared to a drum. The art of making a fine musical instrument, like a violin, is to design those resonators so that they oscillate with the overtones on the string, which is being bowed by the violinist, to bring out the overtones that you want and suppress the others to shape the sound wave so that your ear says, yes, that's a beautiful sound, and I like it. We can come close with a computer to reproducing the sound of a beautiful instrument like this, but we can't actually reproduce the best instruments. I think someday when we're able to do that, and we may well be able to sometime in the future, I think and I hope the musicians will still continue to play the violin rather than generating all their sounds electronically. So let me take you to three dimensions, the thing I'm talking about tonight, the stars. Here's a graphic on the left which is to represent a star, and it behaves much like an organ pipe. The center of the star down inside is a node, like the base of an organ pipe, and the surface of the star, like the end of an open pipe or a woodwind instrument, is an antinode. And so when the star pulsates, it swells and contracts spherically symmetrically, and the color change you're seeing there is a temperature change. It's getting hotter and cooler, bigger and smaller, brighter and dimmer. The nodes for the star, for this radial case, instead of being points on a string or circles on a drum head, are concentric shells inside the stars in the graphic on the right-hand side. The stars, being three-dimensional, though, can oscillate in two other directions. They can have the equator of the star be a node, and the north pole swells up while the south pole contracts, and vice versa. Here's an example. The temperature's changing. We thought up until the 1970s this was impossible for stars. And then my colleague and friend Jorn Christensen Dalsgaard, who was the second author on that book I showed you earlier, proved when he was a graduate student that stars could do this. And then I found an entire class of stars that do that, and the sun does too, and we've had lots of applications to stars and looking inside them with this particular oscillation mode. For those of you who are real physics aficionados, the solution to the way gas spheres vibrate are called spherical harmonics. Students who take quantum mechanics use those functions to learn about quantum mechanics and solve the hydrogen atom, but they were first invented for vibrating spheres, which the stars are. And so those little numbers down at the bottom are what we call quantum numbers that describe what I'm telling you about graphically. Here's two more kinds of modes stars can pulsate in three-dimensionally. On the left is a quadrupole mode with two lines of latitude that are nodes. The poles swell up while the equator contracts and vice versa. The temperature's changing. The amplitude's exaggerated. In the real stars, it's not got quite such a big range, but this is the shape change. Or you can have nodes that are lines of longitude, and then the whole pattern rotates. And that lets us look inside the star and see how the currents are flowing inside it, see how it rotates inside. And I'll come back to that when I tell you about the sun in just a little while. So is this what I do? I'm an astroseismologist, and I get a big ear, and I go out, and I listen to the stars. Well, you've already been saying to yourselves, but wait a minute. Sound can't travel in a vacuum. Sounds can't come here from the stars. If you were an astronaut standing on the moon, along with another astronaut, your radios failed, and your helmets were a centimeter apart, you could scream your heads off. You wouldn't hear each other through the vacuum between you. You could touch your helmets together, and the vibrations would pass through. So how do I hear the stars? And it's very much like a cell phone, mobile phone conversation for you. You get on your phone, you put it to your ear, and you call up Mom. Hi, Mom. And she says, well, hi, kid. And out of your phone comes your mom's voice. Well, really? Sounds like her, doesn't it? But did her voice really come to you? And the answer is no. Her voice was analyzed and turned into a microwave signal, and microwaves are just long wavelength light. And that long wavelength light was beamed to a tower, repeated, sent down to your phone, where the information in that long wavelength light, those microwaves, was converted back into electrical information that drove a speaker, and your mother's voice was reproduced. The stars vary in brightness. They get brighter and dimmer, they come towards us and move away, and I can watch the light arriving here at the Earth and then analyze that light and reproduce what the sounds must be inside the star. So the sound doesn't come to me directly. Here's one way I measure the sounds in the stars. That's called a light curve. Time runs along the bottom axis. It's one day. Brightness on the other axis, and the star gets brighter and dimmer as it pulsates. The other way I do this, and here's some data I took with a very large telescope in Chile, is I measure using the Doppler effect, the star's surface coming towards me and going away. Now, the Doppler effect you're familiar with. You know it when a siren goes by and the pitch of the siren drops. You know it when you're watching a Formula One race of race cars and the car comes down the straightaway and goes, meow. You hear that drop in pitch. That frequency shift from the Doppler shift we can use for the stars. The light coming to us shifts to higher energy, blue when the star is coming towards us, and to the red when it's going away, As it oscillates, I can get a curve like this and extract the information of the sounds that are present. My friend Zoltan Koloth, very clever with his animations and his sound, and he and two of his colleagues, Geza Kovach, Robert Bouchler, designed a horn which has the frequency response of a pulsating star called a Cepheid, and I'm going to tell you about that star in just a moment. Fortunately, they searched for a star that wasn't too dissonant. It's got a rather pleasing set of harmonics. And Zoltan programmed it to play a little Bach prelude. And so here's Bach as you've never heard him before, played by an instrument that is an actual star. What's interesting about the Cepheid variables? A little over 100 years ago, 1908, Henrietta Leavitt, working at Harvard College Observatory, discovered for the Cepheid variables something we call the period-luminosity relationship. She said it's worthy of notice that the brighter variables she's studying have the longer periods. What she found was that for these Cepheid variables, which pulsate spherically symmetrically, the big ones, the giant ones that are bright, have very slow sound speed, and the sound has a long way to travel, and so they play bass. And the small ones, which are denser and a bit hotter, the sound moves faster, it doesn't have as far to go, they play treble. The small stars are the piccolos, the big stars are the tubas of the stellar orchestra. Why was that important? Well, she showed that there was a direct relationship between how bright the stars were and how long it took them to pulsate. There are two kinds of Cepheids. That's her original curve. Over on the right is a more modern one. Distance in astronomy is very hard to measure. Other than very close to our own sun, where we can measure by triangulation, as in that movie To Orion you saw, we have to get clever to measure distances out beyond our own galaxy. The Cepheid variables are one of the main ways we do that. It's easy to go out and watch a star and get brighter or dimmer. Hey, it took 10 days. Oh, well, if it took 10 days, then that's how bright it really is. It looks fainter than that because it's farther away. And this is the first step in the distance scale to measuring the expansion rate of the universe, the age of the universe. It led to our understanding of the Big Bang, beginning of the universe. That man's name you probably know well, Hubble, after whom the Hubble Space Telescope's named. A decade, 15 years after Henrietta Leavitt first discovered her period-luminosity relationship, he discovered a Cepheid variable in the great galaxy in Andromeda. And here's a picture taken with the biggest telescope on the planet at that time, the 100-inch Hooker on Mount Wilson in California, and there's the Cepheid variable he discovered. He was able to measure the period. Over here on the left, you see a modern ground-based picture of the Andromeda Galaxy, and then up on the right, you see an amazing Hubble Space Telescope picture. Hubble Space Telescope's the same size as the telescope that Hubble had, but because it's in space, look at the difference in detail that you can see. By measuring how long that star took to pulsate, he measured how far away this galaxy was, and we went from thinking that that was a little fuzzy gas cloud in our own Milky Way to realizing that this was another island universe, another 400 billion stars like the Milky Way, 2 million light years away. And Hubble then, very shortly thereafter, discovered the expansion of the universe and used these stars with the sounds in them to measure the expansion rate. So, hardest thing you're going to get from me tonight is this. How does it work? How does seismology, astroseismology, let me look inside the stars? This is a graphic cutaway of the inside of a star. There's the center of the star there. And I have a sound wave which is traveling down into the star. It's a pressure wave. The bottom of the sound wave is deeper than the top, and the star is hotter closer to the center. The hotter it is, the faster the sound moves, and so the wave curves back to the surface. But it can't get out into the vacuum. It bounces. And so it's trapped inside the star. Some waves travel deeply into the star. Some of them are very shallow near the surface. It depends on how many nodes they have on the surface. In the case of the sun, we can see 2 million independent frequencies in the sun, and we can map out the sound speed in the sun from the surface to the core over the entire sun to a precision of a few parts in 1,000. And that's what gives me that view inside the sun, better than the face of that fetus I showed you back at the beginning. Stars are not the only place where this is applied. March 11th last year, 2:46 in the afternoon, I was sitting in my visitor's office on the 10th floor of one of the two towers of the Physics and Astronomy building at the University of Tokyo. And we had an earthquake. I think you maybe heard about it. This graphic shows you the intensity of that earthquake. These circles represent various earthquakes in Japan. The bigger the circle is, the bigger the earthquake. This little arm shows you how deep it is. Horizontal, it's near the surface. Vertical, it's very deep down. And I'm going to start this running. It starts in late February, and you'll see the background rate of earthquakes in Japan. And then you'll see the precursor on March the 9th, and then the big one hits. It hasn't stopped yet. After a big earthquake like that, the entire Earth shakes for over a month in the kinds of modes that I've been showing you, and that allows a geoseismologist to look inside the Earth, tell you that the core is made of molten iron on the outside, solid iron in the center, where the mantle starts. We can look inside the Earth as we do the stars. When I came down from that earthquake, 3 hours later, I got back to my office. I obviously left too quickly to take a picture on the way out, but that's what it looked like when I got back in. Now, a few years ago, my wife and I were on a cruise to the north of Norway, and on July the 8th, I took a picture of the sun at midnight. And there's the sun as we know it. That's the midnight sun off the North Cape in Norway. A friend of mine is an astronomer in Tromsø, and he told me that a woman from California, from Los Angeles, came to talk to him once. Now, you're Canadians, you're smart, you know what Californians are like. So it won't surprise you to hear that she came to him and said she had seen the midnight sun. And when she got back to Los Angeles, she was suing her travel agent because she came to see the midnight sun and all she got to see was the regular old sun. That's what you think of as the regular old sun, but I have to tell you that the regular old sun's not so regular. The regular old sun is full of activity. This is a space movie in ultraviolet light that you can't see, so we've colored it green. It's sped up. You can see the sun rotating. I put a little circle in the upper right to show you the relative size of the Earth. It would be much further away on that scale if I put it to scale to distance, but that's the size of the Earth. And you see that the sun has storms. It has magnetic fields that snap. They break. There are flares and there are coronal mass ejections, and those things blast the Earth. You know, an X-class flare, if it went off when we had astronauts beyond the Van Allen radiation belts, as we did back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, on the way to the moon, between Apollo 16 and 17, there was an X-class flare that had the astronauts been out there, they would have been killed instantly, just like that. We just took a chance. They were brave. When we send people back to the moon, we're going to have to provide a bit more protection for them. These solar storms, the way they affect the Earth, you know that about here in Canada. March 9th. 1989. All those motorists sitting at the traffic lights cursing should realize it's not Hydro-Quebec's fault. Canada got blasted and all of Quebec had a blackout for about 9 hours, I think it was. How do we protect ourselves against those? Well, the first thing we have to do is just watch for them. What happens as the sun rotates when one of these big storms disappears around the other side? Is it going to be dangerous? Is it coming back again? Well, I have to tell you, it never disappears anymore. We can see the other side of the sun with sound. We watch those storms with sound all the time. The sound interacts with the magnetic field, and that tells us where the spots are and how they're behaving. We not only see inside the sun, we see around it, we see the surface. This is one of my favorite diagrams in my entire field of research. This shows what the inside of the sun's like for its rotation, and that was something we could never have known without astroseismology. There's Eddington's quote I started with. This diagram shows a cutaway graphic of the sun. Here's the center of the sun. That's its equator. This is its rotation axis. And we've known for centuries that at the equator, the sun takes about 25 days to rotate. Up at the poles, it takes about 35 days. It doesn't rotate as a solid like the Earth. It's made of gas, and the equator goes around very quickly. Well, we had all sorts of theoretical models from our theoretical physics for that when I was a student. They were all wrong. We can now see inside the sun, and we see the rotation. And what we can see is that deep inside the sun, it rotates with a period of about 27 days, and there are tremendous easterly winds blowing at the equator and westerlies at the pole. And it's those winds and the shear of them, as they tear through the magnetic field, that twists the magnetic field and pulls it to the surface. and snaps it to create these storms on the sun. And so for us to understand the dangers from the sun, we need to look inside the stars, and this helioseismology is the technique that we have to do that. Now, there's a picture of something called a globular cluster taken from the ground in the top diagram from the Hubble Space Telescope down at the bottom. Our galaxy has about 150 globular clusters in it. They formed when the galaxy was born, 13 billion years ago, and the stars in that globular cluster are made of hydrogen, helium, and essentially nothing else. We know when the galaxy was born, there was only the hydrogen and helium and a few trace elements from the Big Bang. Now, you've got hydrogen in your water. That makes up most of your body. And that hydrogen is primordial. It came out of the Big Bang. But your carbon, the oxygen you're breathing, the nitrogen, the iron in your hemoglobin, those atoms didn't exist when the galaxy was born. They got cooked up in nuclear reactions in stars and then blown out into space. So when the sun formed 4.5 billion years ago, it was contaminated with 2% material other than hydrogen and helium, and some of that's condensed into the Earth, and a little bit of it is temporarily you and me. You're made of stardust. When the sun dies, it will have converted hydrogen to helium to make its energy, and then helium to carbon. And we long ago calculated that the death states of stars like the sun, they shrink to the size of the Earth, and when they get very old, their carbon cores solidify. Here's an artist's impression from a Harvard press release from my colleague Travis Metcalf, who's now at the High Altitude Observatory in Boulder, Colorado. We've calculated that that carbon inside the stars turns into a crystal of diamond about the size of the Earth. Next time you think of that little poem written by Anna Jane Taylor in London in 1806, "Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are, up above the world so high, like a diamond in the sky, the galaxy's full of diamonds the size of the Earth." Now, is that some wild story? You know, Mark Twain once said, "Science is absolutely fascinating. You get such a wholesale return of conjecture out of such a trivial investment of fact." And he was having a dig at us scientists. But there's some truth in what he says. Could this possibly be true? Well, there's a way to test it. Some of these stars vibrate, and their waves that go through them can test the theory. And a group of us, we call ourselves the Whole Earth Telescope, tested this star. Its real name's BPM-37093. We just call it Bruce for a nickname. And it sounds like this. Those sounds show that Bruce is partially crystallized. The theory is correct. The diamonds are up there. From a supercomputer at the University of Minnesota, 2 terabytes of data originally, it was fortunately reduced to put on my computer, is a model of one of these pulsating red giant stars. The red and the blue are temperature changes. All that was put into this model was convection, boiling of the gas. And that boiling, as in the sun, makes the star a very noisy environment. There's sounds everywhere. And the star just begins to oscillate with its natural frequencies from the energy, from the random sound, from the noise. This is much like an opera singer singing just the right note to get a wine glass oscillating until it shatters with its natural frequency. The stars pick up all this noise from the storms and the convection, and they begin to oscillate. And this is a good look at what a star like a red giant would look like, sped up. And that was the thumpity-dumpity you heard back at the beginning. The pulsating red giant, Xi Hydri is its name. Let me now take you to another subject which is very closely related to the sounds of the stars, and it's something I'm working on intensively now. That's the hunt for another Earth. One of the biggest questions we humans can ask is, are we alone? Are we the only intelligence in the universe? Is there other life out there? Is there other intelligent life out there? You already have an answer in your own mind what you think. I have an answer in my mind what I think too, but I'm a scientist. I don't know. The first step to finding out is to find other planets like the Earth. We're now doing that with something called the Kepler mission, the Kepler Space Telescope, and so I call this the new Keplerian revolution. There's what the Kepler Space Telescope looks like. It's 1 meter in diameter for the mirror, and it orbits the sun, not the Earth. Now, nearly 30 years ago, I was invited to a meeting in San Diego, California, because I, at that time, was making the most precise measurements of the brightnesses of stars of anybody on the planet. And a man had a meeting because he wanted to discover planets around other stars by watching the tiny dip in the light of a star if a planet passed in front of it. And after a week's meeting, we just said to him, no hope. You can't do it. There's just no chance. You'd have to get into space, and the technology wasn't there. That man had incredible perseverance. His name's Bill Borucki. And he pushed, and he applied to NASA, and he was turned down, and he reapplied, and he built teams. And in 2009, he invited me and the rest of the team working on this to come to Cape Canaveral to watch this thing launched. It's in space now, and it's finding planets around other stars. Most of the planets known outside the solar system come from this mission. The Kepler mission's looking at a single piece of the sky in the constellation Cygnus and Lyra. This is the Northern Cross, or Cygnus the Swan here. There's the bright star Deneb, and there's Vega, and it's looking just between Vega and Deneb at a patch of the sky, looking at 150,000 stars simultaneously with, at the time, one of the biggest cameras ever built. 42 CCDs, looking at 105 square degrees of sky. This is a 95 megapixel camera. And just to go back to that question, what good is astronomy? And to get off the dancing and the discos, we astronomers develop CCDs to observe the skies. And the technology that you use in your camera phone, in your webcams, in your digital camera, came directly out of the research astronomers and engineers working in astronomy were doing to develop cameras for astronomy. They then moved mainstream. That's a pretty big payoff. That camera is looking at that piece of sky, and what it's trying to do is find planets like the Earth, orbiting stars like the Sun, in what we call the Goldilocks zone. Not too hot, not too cold, where water can be liquid. It's called the habitable zone. Around a star like the Sun, it would be the same distance the Earth is, this green zone. Most stars are faint little stars, and the planet would have to be closer. Some stars are hotter and bigger than the Sun, the planet would have to be further. So that's what we're looking for. The technique's called a transit. There's a picture of a real transit of a planet in front of the Sun. That's Venus in front of our Sun in 2004, June the 8th. Back in the early 1600s, Johannes Kepler invented his laws of motion, and he calculated that Venus would pass in front of the Sun in 1631. Nobody watched it. And then a young boy, a teenager in England by the name of Jeremiah Horrocks, you might have noticed that I work at the Jeremiah Horrocks Institute, just a few miles down the road from my own observatory, my own department, recalculated Kepler's laws. As a teenager, he mastered Keplerian astronomy better than anyone else in Europe, and he saw that there was going to be a transit of Venus in 1639, and he observed it. That set in motion the idea that we could use that to find the distance to the Sun. Nobody knew what the Sun was. Nobody knew how far away it was. If you could watch Venus pass in front of the Sun and time it, you could tell exactly where it passed across the Sun, and that would depend where you are on the Earth. Go from one point of the Earth to the other, and you'd see it in a slightly different direction. You could triangulate the distance to Venus. And so that idea got out in science. Now, these transits of Venus, you get two of them 8 years apart, and then you have to wait more than a century. So the next transit came in 1761. And a little boat called the Seahorse sailed out of Southampton in England in December of 1760. The two astronomers, Charles and Jeremiah, thought they wouldn't be home for a year. They were home 3 hours later with 11 dead and 37 wounded. It was during the Seven Years' War, and they'd sailed into the guns of a French frigate called Le Grand. And having been blown out of the water, they sent a message to the Royal Society and to the Royal Navy saying, this expedition's off, we're never getting back on that ship. They immediately got a message back, the mail was twice a day back then, saying, should you fail in your duty, you'll be a disgrace to the nation, we'll prosecute you to the full extent of the law, and your lives will be ruined. And they said that they saw this now in a new light. So when they sailed out in February of 1761, a couple of months later, they got to Cape Town in South Africa, and to their great delight, they discovered the French had taken Sumatra. And so they observed the transit from Cape Town successfully. For the transit observations to work, you have to measure your position. And so they surveyed their position on the Grand Parade below Table Mountain to such precision that the Royal Navy knew the distance from Greenwich in England to Cape Town better than they knew the distance to Paris in Europe. These guys were famous. Charles and Jeremiah were known throughout the British Empire. And so down south in the British colonies, two of the families, the Penn family and the Baltimore family, had had a battle about where the boundary should be between their colonies, Maryland and Pennsylvania. The lawyers settled that in 1763, and they wanted the greatest surveyors in the British Empire to come survey the boundary. So Charles and Jeremiah came to North America, and they surveyed the boundary. And when they were done 4 years later, it was named after them. The names were Charles Mason and Jeremiah Dixon. It was called the Mason-Dixon Line. It divided north from south, free state from slave state. and the whole south of the U.S. is now called Dixie after Jeremiah Dixon. 8 years later, the transit of Venus was off on the other side of the planet to be seen from Tahiti, which was only just then being explored by Europeans. The Royal Navy decided to send a ship out of Whitby in Yorkshire, and they could get no Royal Navy captain to take command. Nobody wanted to do that. What career-making move is it to take some astronomers around the other side of the world to watch a planet pass in front of a star? And so they finally got a young lieutenant to take command of the ship. Now, he had made a bit of a name for himself surveying off Newfoundland and the St. Lawrence River. His name was James Cook. The ship was the Endeavour, and it was the greatest sailing expedition of all time. These transits of Venus are historically important, and we did discover how far away the star, the sun, is. And we then discovered we didn't know where its energy came from, and that then drove the physics to find the energy of the sun. Venus will pass in front of the sun on June the 5th, next month, as seen from here, KW, starting at 4 minutes past 6 p.m. You won't be able to see the whole thing. It lasts for 7 hours, but you can watch Venus pass onto the face of the sun. It'll take about 17 minutes. I hope it's clear for you. And then you can see, with eye protection, Venus in front of the sun. That's a transit, and it's your last chance for most of you. The next one will be 2117. There may be some medical development so some of the young people can see it. We now do that with the Kepler Space Telescope. The planet passes in front of another star, and the light dips by a tiny amount. When I was observing from South Africa, I could measure the brightness of a star to one part in 10,000. And I spent, as I said, as Greg told you at the beginning, 2,000 nights of my life at the telescope doing that, one star at a time. The Kepler telescope measures the brightnesses of these stars to one part in a million, and it does 150,000 stars simultaneously, and it doesn't have any sunrise and sunset, and it doesn't have any weather. Everything I did for 20 years is obsolete, and it doesn't matter anymore. And my life's completely revolutionized. It is such fun. So what's Kepler doing? It's trying to find planets like the Earth. There's one over here. There's a Neptune-sized planet and a Jupiter-sized planet. And it wants to find them orbiting in periods like the Earth around the sun, 365 days. We want to find planets here. Before Kepler went up, there's where the planets were found. There were a few transiting planets found, and they were mostly like Jupiter in very short periods. With Kepler, that's the situation today. And so most planets known, over 2,000 of them, around other stars have been found with the Kepler mission. Of course, the thing that we're looking for is here. And we're finally getting there. It's coming. I'll show you in just a moment. A graduate student at Harvard University sure spent a lot of time on that. That little star by itself up there is the sun with Venus in front of it. And to that scale, there's an example of lots and lots of Kepler stars with their planets in front of them. Jack Lissauer at NASA Ames in California and his team have found an entire solar system, 6 planets. But they all orbit closer to the star than Venus does to the sun, so they're too hot. You couldn't have liquid water. But they're finding solar systems, not just individual planets. Natalie Batalha has found Kepler 10b. The star's Kepler 10, 10b is the planet. And let me show you this planet. This graphic's made by artists at NASA of what we think the planet's like. So it passes in front of its star, and the shadow falls on the Kepler telescope, and we see a little dip in the light. The ring you see is just to show you what its orbit's like. It orbits its star in less than a day. And so it's so close, we know that the surface is completely molten. Now, I'd like you to think about Mark Twain again as we watch this. This seems like pretty wild conjecture. We've seen the shadow of the planet pass across the telescope. We've seen a tiny dip in the light, and now I'm telling you the surface is molten, material's being blasted off the surface. We're going to have a look at canyons on the surface of this planet with flowing rivers of lava. Oh my goodness, have we gone off the deep end in conjecture here without any facts? And the answer is no. This graphic movie is plausible. And with a little difficulty now, I'm going to show you how we know what we're showing you in that graphic. Here on the left is the dip in light as the planet passes across the star. That measures how big the planet is compared to how big the star is. That gives us the radius of the planet, it gives us its volume. But to do that, we need to know how big the star is. How do you know how big a star is? Well, if it's all by itself, there's only one way, and it's called astroseismology. With the sounds of the stars, we can measure their size. And that then means when the planet passes across the star, we know how big the planet is. And so with that, that gets us the volume of the planet, how big it is. Then from the ground, we go to the telescope and get some of the biggest telescopes on the planet, and we measure the Doppler shift. As the planet goes around the star, it makes the star wobble towards us and away from us just a little bit. And with that, using Newton's form of Kepler's third law, going back to the original Kepler, we can measure the mass of the planet. So that's a velocity curve in the lower right. And from that, with Kepler's laws, we get the mass of the planet. The mass over the volume gives us the density. With Natalie's planet there, Kepler 10b, we know that that planet is as dense as the core of the Earth. No gas planet can be like that. That planet is rocky. That planet is solid. But it only orbits its star in less than a day. It's so close, it has to be molten on the surface. The star is very like the sun. And so that whole conjecture of that movie you just watched is very plausible, given the information that we have. Now, as a novelty, there's an outtake from the Star Wars movies that's supposedly the fictional Luke Skywalker. And he lived on a planet called Tatooine, which had a double star in the sky, two stars, not just one. Do such things exist? Yes, Kepler's found them. Kepler-16 we call Tatooine. It's a planet like Jupiter, orbiting two stars, one a yellow star like the sun, and then a little faint red star. What does the orbit look like? Well, here's the planet up here. You can see it moving. And the two stars are close together, so the planet orbits about the two of them. And it will have double sunrises and double sunsets, just like the fictional Tatooine from Star Wars. Kepler's found quite a few systems like this with double stars and planets orbiting them. And so finally, with the Kepler mission here, in December last year, at a meeting I was at in California at NASA Ames, the Kepler mission announced the first rocky planet in the habitable zone. It's about twice the size of the Earth, but because it's so much bigger, the gravity's pretty much like it is here in this room. If you went to that planet, it'd be pretty normal gravity. It's in the right distance from the star that water can be liquid. It's a rocky planet. It's not quite Earth-sized, but it's a kind of place where there could be oceans, there could be an atmosphere, there could be life. It's the first step along the way. I think during this year, Kepler's going to announce some real Earth-like planets around stars like the sun. On the right, it shows you a picture of that field of view of Kepler with its 150,000 stars and the position of that particular star on the giant camera that's in the telescope. If you'd like to get involved with this, the data from Kepler's now been made public. Now, some of you come to all these talks, and about 2 years ago, you had an English astronomer named Chris Lintott from Oxford come here who does Zooniverse. And Chris has put the Kepler data onto planethunters.org. And if you go there, you can go looking for planets. And people just like you have done that and have found planets that the computers and the astronomers working on this missed. 150,000 stars, there just aren't enough astronomers. And so you can join in and find planets too. And the last planet I want to show you is one that I and a team that I work on discovered. And it tells us something about the future of the Earth. And it's another technique for finding planets. We found a giant planet like Jupiter orbiting a star that's very old. And what we calculated and what we discovered is that when that star was young, it was a star like the sun, and this planet was the same distance from that star that the Earth is from the sun. The star eventually swelled up until it was a red giant, and it was as big as the distance out to the planet. And our sun one day will do that too. And so you might think, and you might have been told, that someday when the sun becomes a red giant, it will evaporate the Earth, it will completely destroy the Earth, and there'll be nothing left. What we found with this system is that the star loses enough mass, and there's a tidal interaction that the planet drifted away another 70% in distance, and it survived. And so I would like to comfort you. You probably thought that the Earth was to be incinerated in 6 billion years, and I can tell you now that, yes, the atmosphere will be blown away, the oceans will be evaporated, and they'll be blown away, and the continents will melt down into the abyss, but the rock will survive. And I sleep better at night for that myself. Now, with this, we used a timing method. As the planet goes around the star and it tugs the star back and forth, it makes the time, the star pulsates. It's got sounds in it, and the sounds go to higher frequency as the star comes towards us, and it goes to lower frequency going away. And I've been thinking about that for some years. And so working with my close friend and colleague from the University of Tokyo, Hiromoto Shibahashi, we just sat and thought about this, and we struggled. Until we had an idea. We realized, no, wait a minute, you know, the thing we're trying to solve The engineers who do radio engineering did this a long time ago. It's called FM, frequency modulation. And so we went and looked at the radio engineering literature, and we realized we needed to go back centuries to the 1800s for Bernoulli and Bessel, to the 1700s for the great mathematician Lagrange, and we solved all the equations, and we can now find planets, and we can measure the speeds of stars as they orbit about each other without having to go to giant telescopes to take spectra and use all that telescope time using the data directly from Kepler with this new technique that he and I just invented. We published this a couple months ago. We call it the FM stars. And so let me take you back to that question that Eddington asked us at the beginning. What appliance can pierce through the outer layers of a star and test the conditions within? The answer is, of course, astroseismology, the real music of the spheres. If Eddington had been here tonight, he would have been absolutely amazed. I hope you've been both entertained and amazed, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for your attention this evening. Thank you very much.
We will now open the floor to questions. I guess here's the first question. Ready to go, please.
Thank you very much for the great speech. I'd want to know how many, for Kepler, how many transits do you need before you have enough data to actually see all the stuff that you're going to see?
Right, you've asked a very important question, and it's one of the reasons that you have not yet heard of an exactly Earth-sized planet. Imagine that you see this little dip and you say, ah, that dip's just the size of the Earth. How long does it take to go around the star? Now, we want one that takes a year if it's like the sun. You have to wait 2 years till it happens again. But then you say to yourself, oh, was that the same planet, or is this a solar system and that was a different planet? And so you now have to wait another year till you see it again. And that then takes you to 3 years before you begin to discover planets like the Earth around stars like the sun. Kepler mission's been up for 3 years right now. And so it's just getting to the point where what the astronomers think they know, they can finally tell you because they can be sure. It's coming.
And let's go to question number two here on my right.
Hi. With the vibration of the stars, how much does the surface of the star actually move? How big is the magnitude of the vibrations?
Right. Okay. That's a good question, too, and it's tremendously variable. One of the most amazing stars in the sky, which has been known for centuries to be variable, is called Myra the Wonderful. It's a giant, a red supergiant, and it pulsates from about the size of the solar system orbit out to Jupiter to about the size of the solar system orbit out to Saturn. That's a distance 5 times the Earth is the distance from the sun, and that takes several years. On the other hand, the sun we measure so precisely that with the Birmingham Solar Oscillation Network, which measures vibrations in the surface of the sun, this Doppler effect, the Birmingham Solar Oscillation Network can see the sun go up and down by 20 centimeters in a period of 5 minutes with a radius of 700,000 kilometers. We can see the sun do this, and that's the actual scale. So you can have the whole range. For some white dwarfs, which are collapsed stars, the amplitudes are even smaller, and we can still pick up the signal. Anything you like, we can find one doing that.
And a question on my left.
Thank you very much for the lecture. Very simple question. The those clips that you played of those planets, were those actually sped up in terms of pace, or is that really how fast the beat goes?
The sounds that I played for you were of stars, and the frequencies were very sped up. They were multiplied up into the audible. The red giant you were listening to has a fundamental period of about 3 hours, and the deepest thing you can hear is 30 times per second. And so that has been shifted up by about 20 octaves. You might rightfully ask, is that really what it sounds like? And I hate to be honest with you, but here goes. We've taken the sound of a songbird, tweedly, and moved it down 3 octaves to see what it sounds like, and it goes, it doesn't sound anything like a songbird. And so what can I say? When you get too far from human experience, when you put it into the range that we can experience, whether that's really what it would be like if you could see it in its native state is a philosophical question.
Professor, we had a question on the Twitter feed, but you answered it. But just so we're being true to our Twitter feed, the question was, how does transit of a planet affect the sound? But you did, obviously, a wise observer, and then you answered the question with your talk. So thank you for that.
What?
Finally, then, What do we have on the screen here behind you?
I've put up for you here some resources you might like to go to if you'd like to learn a bit more about this. At the top is Zoltan Koloth's website. If you put his name, Zoltan Koloth, Stellar Music Project, into your search engine or that website, you can find that movie of Orion with the sound. You can find other symphonies that he and Jano Koehler have composed. For you musicians, they've got a paper they published for a music conference where they give the conventions they used. So how they added transients to the start of the sounds to get more of a musical sound, how they shifted the sounds and picked the notes they were using, the way they constructed the music. You can find the horn, the Cepheid horn that was playing Bach, and you can find some more information from Zoltan Koloth's website. The movie of the trip to Kepler 10b, the graphics I was showing you for the Kepler mission come from the Kepler space mission website. Those are freely downloadable and you can use them as you like. There is a website run by Travis Metcalf, the one with the diamond star, for astroseismology. It's still a bit tough, not as tough as my book, but there's some accessible stuff there. We'll do something popular someday. We just haven't got around to it yet. And finally, for general astronomy, there's a fantastic website called the Astronomy Picture of the Day. And every day there's a beautiful picture associated with astronomy with a very short paragraph explanation and some links to other things. You can have a quick look, see a beautiful picture. If it catches your attention, there's a way to get more information. That's a wonderful astronomy resource.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome and congratulate Dr. Donald Kirk.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Greg.
Really welcome. Thank you.